Okay, hi everyone. I'm Christian. I'm from South Africa and I work for a company called Retro Rabbit. Today we're going to speak a bit about cache optimized hash tables. Basically, just the unordered map in C++ terms. Basically, we start why optimized for CPU cache. I mean, why? Basically, since the early 2000s, the disparity between the latency of accessing main memory and the actual amount of instructions you can retire within that time frame has become very large. And by today, you can probably retire about 50 instructions for a single main memory access. And the way the CPU manufacturers has tried to mitigate this problem is with cache memory. So basically, if CPU cache memory increases, as you can see there, if your hit rate, which is basically a percentage defined as let's say I'm doing 100 accesses and 96 of those comes from the cache and four of the other four comes from my main memory, it will spend roughly about 96 nanoseconds on accessing the cache, and then the other 4% that is missing, it will spend 200 nanoseconds accessing main memory. So if I add just 1% to that hit rate, my overall time that it took to do the 100 accesses will drop from around about 300 to about 250, which is like, I don't know, it's a whole 25%, just because my efficiency has increased by 1%. Also, the CPU doesn't do much while it's waiting for memory because it doesn't know what to do, it doesn't have instructions to retire. And of course, in multi-core and concurrent programming where there's a lot of threads accessing the CPU, there's only one memory bus. It's only one little thin straw through which the CPU is trying to get some air. So this is why we'd like to, you know, just get that 1%, 1 or 2% extra. So I'm just going to talk a bit further about how caches look. Basically, each region in memory is called a cache line in the normal normal terms. We can call it a block or a page or whatever. Basically, the normal cycle is CPU asks for some memory. It talks to the cache controller. The cache controller says, yes, I have the memory. Or if it doesn't and it's full, it needs to evict some other page cached inside. So it uses the least recently used algorithm. We're going to just assume it uses least recently used algorithm. And we're just going to assume also that the associativity, which is how well it actually can access the blocks, or how well the addresses that it needs is associated with the blocks, is a fully associative cache. We're not going to worry about 8-way or 4-way or 16-way associativity or anything like that. Some of the techniques we can use to actually make sure that data we want at that point in time actually sits in cache is to firstly make sure that when the cache retrieves a block, that most of that data that it retrieves is actually stuff that we're interested in. Doesn't help I in a typical case, retrieve the cache line is about 64 bytes. So I'm only interested in 4 bytes. So it fills up the rest of the cache with memory, which I'm never going to use. And it's going to cause other stuff to be evicted, which I want to use. Obviously, another sort of often overlooked thing I can do is to just reduce memory use, because the less memory you have, the better the chances that the cache will actually contain the memory or the data that you're interested in. Also, there's some mention, I'm not going to go too deeply into the, the instruction caches, but obviously, if the compiler inlines code with other code that also gets called frequently, the less frequently called code will actually wipe some of the functions in the instruction cache as well. And then we have LRU, locality of reference. So when I'm accessing memory in the cache and it needs to evict stuff, I need to make sure that the stuff it evicts is stuff I'm not going to use in the near future. So that's basically, I have a fancy word called temporal locality of reference. But also, all things being equal, when you're accessing memory, you're likely to access the memory around that memory again very soon. Right. So going a little bit deeper into blocks and pages. So this is just a little picture. The black or the gray parts are the memory that I'm interested in, and the red parts are memory that I'm not interested in. So obviously, if you have some, it's better to put all the stuff you need into contiguous blocks. As you can see there, the top part, there's one little pointer, see if it works. Oh, can you see anything? There, okay. You can see there the red spots are interleaving with the gray blocks, and yeah, obviously I'm retrieving a lot of memory there that I don't need, whereas this one is a bit better. It's a lot less memory that I don't need when I'm putting stuff into the cache. But it's up to you. I mean, each workload has its own, its own little profile of memory that it wants and memory that it doesn't want. And sometimes it's a bit difficult to actually decide in which memory you're going to choose as a algorithm designer or data structure coder. Which memory you're going to prefer. Right. So obviously, reducing memory use is always better. So you can see there on the first. In the worst access scenario, there's some memory extra there that doesn't fit into the cache line, and obviously that's going to cause another another main memory access, whereas the one at the bottom here may not cause another memory access. So in the worst one, we're actually waiting. The CPU is doing nothing again. It's waiting for more memory to be loaded from RAM. Right. This one, if it's possible within your little cache algorithm or data structure or algorithm or whatever memory access pattern, if there are parts of your memory that you need a lot, it would be good to put all that stuff in a contiguous block. That will ensure, well not ensure, but it will make the likelihood higher that you're going to be able to access that bits of memory again. But it all depends on how you, what kind of memory profile you have and how you're going to access it. So here is a bit of a complicated diagram. So we're talking about the concept of specific optimality and optimization generality. Now, by specific optimality, I mean it's in some situations, you actually just need a little bit of memory to fully optimize that algorithm or loop or whatever. Whereas in general, the more general your solution is or algorithm, I can probably contrast that with iteration through an array versus random access or binary search on an array. The binary search on an array is a more general algorithm, while the iteration through the array is a very specific, and it requires less code, basically. So while you may not be able to optimize every little thing in general, it doesn't stop you from actually optimizing the specific cases for specific memory. Also, the cache hierarchy on CPUs as we know them today, if you start with registers, they're about the fastest they can basically keep pace with the CPU with the full instruction retire rate of the CPU. The L1 is a bit larger, but it's about 4 times slower, and so on and so on. And when you get to the L3, it's about 10 times slower, which is still 5 times faster than main memory. Right, so hash tables, yippee. So you get mainly the two types. You get open addressing and closed addressing. There's some examples of algorithms that they use. There's linear probing, Robin Hood hashing, quadratic probing is one of the other ones. Quadratic probing is the one they used in Google Sparse Hash and Google Dense Hash. There isn't really an open source that use pure linear probing because of the requirements for a uniform distribution of the keys. It's pretty strict. But I'll show you why later. And then our closed addressing, which is examples of that, is typically the actual hash tables you use in the STL. You can see that with the chaining and linked lists, when you're looking up a specific key or value, you're very likely to actually do two lookups, or at least to address two memory loads because of the linked lists that's associated with each bucket in the hash table. Right, I'm going very quickly. So one of the techniques that people use, it's quite a common one, is to basically just take the, so, okay, before we go there, I'm just gonna be specifically talking about linear probing and linear probing type hash tables because they are known to be much more cache friendly than the other algorithms. So we won't really look at all the other algorithms in the closed addressing things, except that there's a bucket, because we'll be using a bucket a little bit later on. So the first thing after that is looking at, so we're looking at linear probing hash tables now. It's not any hash table, it's a open addressing type scheme. So the first thing that people can do, which helps with keeping the improving the cache performance or the cache efficiency, is to, let's say, separate keys and values during the normal ADT type operations. You're accessing the keys a lot more than you're actually accessing the values, if you think about it. So always to check, for instance, if something is in the hash table, you're only going to use keys. If you check to see if you can erase something, all that stuff is only going to use keys. For the normal, we'll see a bit later, the normal linear probing algorithm, there is a sort of a scan sometimes when the hash table becomes full, which only accesses the key. So it's better to separate the keys from the values, because then you know that if you load something, or if the cache has a miss and it loads a cache line from main memory, the stuff that you're loading is, again, stuff that you're actually interested in. Right, so, yes, Lonely. Yeah.
You said, doesn't it guarantee that you'll have at least two cache misses, one for the keys and one for the values?
That's a good question. How to put it? The main thing there is to actually not, you see in this one, you always have one cache miss actually, because let's take a sort of idealized case where the keys are in the one side and the values are on the other side, and we sort of assume that the keys are in the cache already. Then you're gonna miss only once when you access the value, because the keys are already in the cache. But the thing here is that you're not putting large values in the cache when they are going to cause a lot of cache misses. When they're gonna cause the cache to fill up, because it's just extra stuff that you're putting in the cache that you're not really going to use. Look, we're only looking for that 1% of improvement. We're not looking for trying to get everything in the cache. We're looking for a small improvement here. Okay, now I'm just going to explain a bit what happens with linear probing. So you can see the green keys, or the green blocks, or occupied keys. The blue ones are empty, and the yellow ones are deleted keys. So deleted keys, as you can see, you have to assign some state to each. The first problem, sort of on superficially, is you have to have something that keeps the state for each of those keys. The common way of doing that is just to actually using your key space itself to set the states for those keys. So you would have a deleted key. So let's say you have a lot of integers. You would typically assign -1 as the deleted key and -2 as your empty key. Your occupied keys can be anything that isn't empty or deleted. This is basically how the Google Dense Hash works, so it's a bit irritating. You have to actually go and look at what you're going to do with it, and then assign keys according to that, which is a bit of a pain sometimes. Now, looking at the linear probing algorithm itself, you can see there, when you delete keys, they don't actually get removed from the probe length, because if there was a collision, let's say there at the beginning, let's say that key had a collision. So that means, so collisions means that if I insert the key, let's take a hash table of length 8, and I want to insert the values of 4 and 12. So 4 and 12 will both map to the same position in this hash table. Let's, for instance, for just for our example, say it's that one. That means that we have to put, so we've already stored 4, we have to put 12 somewhere. So the linear probing, probing algorithm chooses the next one. And if I add 8, so that will be 4 plus 8, that's 20. So in this example, there was a number of keys which mapped to a position somewhere here, and then a little bit later on, they deleted them again. But this leaves a whole block here, which is so anytime I'm looking for a key that falls in this block, it's going to do a lot of iterations here. It's very costly, obviously. And also those iterations has to actually iterate through that memory, and it fills up the cache with even more stuff that you don't need and or may not need, but it keeps the CPU very busy. So we want to improve that a bit. So this is basically just so you can see from this diagram, we need to have a very strongly randomized hash function so that you have enough spaces between the keys so that those iterations don't carry on for too long. So we're sort of forced to make the hash table a bit bigger so that we can have little spaces in, and then that obviously causes worse locality of reference and makes the table bigger than it really needs to be. There are some solutions to some of those problems, especially the they call this clustering. This clustering, some of them are quadratic programming, quadratic probing, using Google DNChess, and there's also something like Robinhood hashing, which helps with that. But with quadratic probing, this each time you start probing, you increasing the probing length quadratically. So that's also bad for the cache, because now you're also making large leaps in reading stuff you don't necessarily need right now. So the locality of reference of quadratic probing is a bit worse than, especially if you want to keep the table small and you want to have a high load factor. Right, so here we have some examples of low and high factor. So there you can see low load factor, it means there's a few keys per empty space. High load factor has a lot of keys per empty space. And you can see it quickly starts generating long runs or large clusters, which is a bad thing. So to improve that, we're going to change the actual states that get stored per key. The one is to exchange the deleted key with a thing called a collided key. And that's basically where we have this word called collision factor. So collision factor just means the amount of keys of the table size, not the total size of the table, just the amount of keys per total keys which are actually in a collided state. So in other words, if I've inserted something on that key and then later on created a hash value which maps to the same key and then inserted it somewhere else there, wherever there was a space, it will be counted as a collision. So you can see there with the collided flags. So firstly, I have to just point out that this table is equivalent to that one. So we don't have deleted keys anymore, so those spaces go open. Here is a yellow one, so we're going to say that one was collided, and that one as well. So you can see, just by changing the deleted flag into a collided state, deleted state into a collided state, we've reduced a bit of the clustering. But of course, now you don't have a deleted key, which means how do you stop searching once you know something is collided? And the thing we elected to do is to just make sure all runs or all probes are of equal length. So if there is a collided key, it will probe for a preset length. We'll go a bit into that a bit later. But basically, this improves two things. First, you've got a lot more space to put other stuff in, so your hash table will grow slower. And secondly, because you're limiting the runs here that you can scan, the clusters will obviously not exceed the size of that constant run there, whereas that run is very long, this one is much shorter. Okay, so any questions? But that is not enough. We want to actually improve the memory use a bit more. So this is where the bucket at the end of the table comes from. So if I store a key, and if you look at the previous one here, if I store a key there, okay, then it fills up that spot. But if I store another key that maps to somewhere there, it has to go somewhere. So at that point, usually you would just call a rehash, but we can actually do a bit better. We can put a little bucket at the end. So whenever those probes are exhausted, we just put a key in the bucket. As it turns out, the probability of these things getting full is fairly low. So you can sort of think for yourself that if I insert a key into a position where there's k other consecutive keys, that the probability of that event occurring is fairly low. That's why this bucket basically works. And then the next thing we do is to actually take all the states, and instead of using the keys themselves to store the colors or the states, which would be occupied, empty, and collided states, we use a separate bitmap to go and store it in. So that bitmap becomes sticky in cache because it's quite small. It's like for 8-byte keys, it's like 32 times smaller than the total hash table. So the likelihood of that thing being in cache is a lot, although it does incur a couple of extra processing cycles to actually do a shift and a load here before you can actually access a key. Alright, so this the birthday paradox or the birthday attack is a problem with almost all hash tables, where the probabilities of keys colliding becomes quickly very very high very quickly. And basically all I want to say here is that it's a good article to read. Go Google the birthday attack article on Wikipedia, and then we can basically just model collisions on a hash table the same way they model collisions in secure hashing algorithms. The probabilities and stuff is almost the same. Well, not the same, but they are in the same sort of area, and it makes it easier to reason about from a functional point of view than to try and go and look at the probabilities of linear probing and quadratic probing hash tables. Okay, there's some benchmarks. So you can see there, we've got dense hash map. Dense hash map in blue, so that's the Google one, the fast Google one. The red one is the Rabbit. So this is for fetch, random fetch times in nanoseconds. Then the sparse hash map, which is the Google app, it's basically a type of hash map that is a lot fewer spaces between keys. That's why they call it sparse, because it doesn't have a lot of space wasted, so it actually uses less memory. And then the normal unordered map, that's part of the STL distributions. So there you can see, I think the times here is about 20% or so faster than the fastest one.
How large are the maps?
It's 10 million keys. But it's, you'll see the same pattern reoccur with 100 millions, doesn't matter. It just, obviously if you've got 100 million, the ratios stay the same, so obviously just the actual times which goes a bit higher because you've got more cache misses. So this is just for random access. For map growth, you can see you've got more like a 50 or even 100% improvement in map growth. And that's mainly because of the little bitmap that we use. We don't actually need to compare all the heavy keys when you do a resize of the hash map. And obviously because it's much smaller, you resize much less because of the higher load factor that it can withstand. And you can also use more cache-friendly distributions. So you don't have to strongly randomize all your keys to get a, because you don't really need a great dispersal because you've got that collision bit which avoids the scanning of the keys. Carry on a bit. Okay, this is where gets much better actually. So if you look at green there, that's the size of 10 million keys in the STL map. The blue is the Google Dense Hash map, and then the Google Sparse Hash map, as well as Rabbit, uses about the same amount of memory. Actually, Rabbit uses a little less even. But it's basically the same. I just have to sort of say that there are some transients because Rabbit is a variant on linear probing. It does have to resize the hash map from time to time. That means you have to make a copy of the hash map and then insert all the keys from the old version and then delete the old version. So you have transient spikes. So it's not quite as low. Even though it looks low here, it's not quite as low as the Google Sparse Hash Map. But it's much better than all the other ones anyway. While it's actually faster than everything else. Okay, so that was that for just sort of giving you an overview of the algorithms. So now I would like to show you a bit about how the HashMap, the thing actually works within the actual. So here we have some profiling information that I did a bit earlier. And this is basically the workload is the link bench from Facebook. So you can see there, there's a lot of stuff happening here. If you look at the functions, let's see what's going on here. So you've got a lot of locking, there's a lot of compression and stuff like that. Let's sort this a bit. Okay. But there is, so that's just some code within the, and if you go up a bit, it's basically in the allocator. So it's just a allocator that we wrote for doing some improving the concurrent performance of the existing OS allocators. And basically, it's sort of like the malloc or one of those anyway. It's not really, but basically, there's a lot of code there that we can see the find method gets called a lot. So obviously random access, random read access is quite important in that workload. And again, we can see here, it does some strange things here. When we look at the code here, it's basically all cache misses. So even though we try to optimize the hash table for cache efficiency, due to all the other things happening, memory allocation, stuff being encoded from one buffer to another one, cache misses are quite predominant anyway. So that's basically that part. Okay. I think I'm sort of finished. If there's any questions, anything that's unclear to you, I'd like to maybe help you a bit. Let me just see if I can get back to this. Let me just talk about deletes. You can see that deletes and replacements are also going to be much faster in this case, because we're only setting bits, we're not actually overwriting the whole key to signal that thing is missing. But it depends on how you use the hash table and so on. Okay, right. Any questions? Yeah.
So this rabbit hash, is this conforming to the unordered containers, or is it something?
Yeah, it actually does. It has the normal iterators and all the like find, add, or insert const iterators, all that kind of stuff it supports. The only thing is with the key pair is like the, I think it's called the value type, isn't quite the same because of that split here. It's a bit back, sorry. if I go back. Yeah, because of that split, the keys and values aren't in the same memory, so the actual value type is a proxy to the actual keys. But it works in the same way. I just think if you do type inference and that kind of thing, it will actually not return what you expect. So in that case, it's not quite conformant. But I'm pretty sure if you use it in a sort of real system, you're not going to have that problem a lot. The other thing is that It's also much more robust against non-uniform distributions of keys because, like I explained earlier, so it's probably, sure.
I have, I guess, an answer to that question. I know that every open address hash perhaps they don't, they violate the requirement of non-invalidating iterators on adding new elements.
Yeah.
Because you reside in the whole table, and when you have nodes in this, they don't invalidate itself. So that was. So I guess that is why it's not impossible to. It's impossible to use this kind of hash maps in the standard.
There's nothing in the standard that says iterators can't be invalidated. We made up the iterator nodes themselves.
The standard actually does.
Yes, but we get to decide what the iterator invalidation rules are for our containers.
Yes.
Well, yeah, but.
But then now it's not a drop and replace on our map.
I have another question about these benchmarks.
Yeah.
Hash function have you used? Because standard hash function in GCC for integer is just return the same value, and in Visual Studio it does something.
Yes, that's right. That's correct. So
I know that for Google Dense map it have a huge performance.
So I just want to repeat for the audience, future audience. so your question is that what is the performance of the hash table with the Visual Studio hash function as opposed to just using integers directly? So what I do for this thing is to just not use the standard hash for integers. I've rewritten but it's still with strings where you have a high probability of birthday attacks. I use the randomization hash function that comes with the compiler or STL, the version of STL, whichever one you're using. So I have to. Yeah, this one is a bit complicated to explain. So there's two phases to the algorithm. There's the first phase where you insert a key and there's no collision. The next phase is if there is a collision, it must probe for a new space. So what it does in that case is to take the size of the hash table. So you get the hash value divided by the size of the hash table, and then you get a number. For instance, if it's 10 times larger than the hash table, then you get 10 and 11 and so on. But before I don't use that number directly as the offset for the probe, where the probe will start, because you can do that, but then you still have a large address space which a potential attacker can use to actually try and fill those buckets up. So we square. So it's, that part is actually like a quadratic hash table. So that means the total address space that an attacker has to actually cause your hash table to fail or expand beyond the available memory is the square root of the total address space. So it's a bit better than, so instead of, if you're using 64-bit keys, the total address space, the hacker can exploit all the funny distribution or whatever, is then 32 bits, because it's half of the total address space, which is sort of the same strategy that they use in the dense hash map as well. Google. Okay. I hope that answers your question. Yeah.
So one question. In your benchmarks for the
compare
against the what load factor do you use as a, your growth decision, and how does it compare to what you want to use?
Okay, so Rabbit doesn't have a fixed load factor. What it does is to, at the end here, if that little bucket at the end is exhausted, that's the trigger for rehashing. So we don't, I know in Google the load factor is half, because that's sort of optimal value for linear probing or open addressing type hash tables. But for this one, it will actually adapt to your specific distribution.
As a follow-up, empirically using your last load factor. At what load factor usually does it trigger the expansion?
Okay. So in the library, there's a. It depends again. in the library, there's a function which calculate the size of the bucket. And that function basically has two modes. It's got a logarithmic mode and it's got a constant mode. So there's a function you call set logarithmic, and if you set it to 1, then you'll take the logarithm of this whole hash table size except for the bucket and make that the size of the bucket. And then you can say set logarithm 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever. To make the hash table resize later and later and later. Obviously making that bucket larger and larger as a performance penalty. But with like these tests that we have is with that logarithmic factor set to 1. So that's about the fastest. And for that specific benchmark input set, in other words, basically I took Google's actual own timing code and then just added a rabbit to it. And then the keys they generate there, the random keys aren't really that random. It's about 20 bits of randomness, so it's not a lot. But with some other tests I've done, which I wanted to show you, but I don't know, it seems like we're not going to have time. We use a full 64 bit of randomness. It still performs very well, much better than DenseHash while using also approximately half the memory. Then you use about then you multiply the bucket size at the end by the logarithm times 2 or times 4 or something like that. It's not just, so it's a bit larger, but it doesn't, it's just to make sure you don't have that last rehash which suddenly makes the table much bigger. Anyway, okay, I hope that sort of answers your question. Okay, well.
So I've been working on some similar hash things, and one of the things I found is in practice, nobody ever deletes keys. Ever. people destroy tables, they throw the whole thing away, but it's usually inserts, finds, and that's it.
Yeah. Well, that's okay, yeah, that's a fair. Observation. All right. So I just want to repeat for the audience that you have sort of did some investigation in the hash maps, and you found that deletion isn't a very popular operation that they do on hash tables. But for those people who has that. For instance, in this, in the link bench code that we use the hash table in, there's quite a lot of, especially in the allocators, obviously. using the hash table in the allocators, yeah, there's going to be a lot of deletes, especially on the per. Because the way that allocator works is that it has a main sort of global allocator which is locked, and then for every thread, there's another little small allocator which evicts least recently used allocation sizes back to the main allocator. And obviously, when you're evicting, you're deleting, and you're unassociating from that. So in that case, yeah, we're definitely using deleting. But for that, in the actual concurrent algorithms where we check store versions per page and that kind of thing, yeah, you're just creating, like you said, you're creating a whole new hash function, and there's some other global hash table that contains the original versions, and that per transaction table just gets discarded when it's finished. It doesn't actually delete anything. Okay, any other questions? No, it's fine. Okay, no, I think I'm finished. Thanks.